Today is Tuesday.
That's right.
December 5th, 1995, and my name is Rick Bradley, and I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, with Bubba Church. Bubba, the first question I have to ask you is, where did the nickname come from?
I have a sister that is 4 years older than I am, and apparently when I hit the ground, everybody said, little brother. She couldn't pronounce little brother. It came out Little Bubba, and I promise you that it has been Bubba ever since. I had two teachers in elementary school, one in high school, and two professors at LSU that called me my real name. The rest of it's been Bubba.
Where did Emery come from? Is that your dad's name?
It's a family name. I was named after my grandfather. My dad's name was John Emery Church. His dad's name was Emery Nicholas Church, and his dad's name, it's a family name.
Your correct birth date, because a lot of these are wrong in the books, is September the 12th of 1924?
That's my correct birthday.
Okay.
I lied. I have to tell you this. When I met my wife, in fact, Ben Chapman is responsible for this. When I went in to sign with him, when I went in to talk to him, he said, how old are you? I said, I'm 22 years old. He said, no, you're not. You're 21. I said, no, I'm 22. He said, no, you're 21. And I got the message real quick, and he said, that's the reason I left the scholarship at Mississippi State, because I had been through World War II, and came home, and I was 22, and had a scholarship at Mississippi State, and I hit 22 down there, and baseball season hadn't even started. And I thought, if you're going to go in baseball, which is what I burningly wanted to do, that was what I really wanted, you better go. So somebody said, go talk to Chapman, and Chapman cut a year off my life, and it's on my marriage certificate. I lied. My wife didn't find out. I mean, the girl I married didn't find out until about 15 years later. It didn't make any difference to her.
You were born here in Birmingham?
In Birmingham. Born in West End, which is a little bit west. It's about 2 miles from the Rickwood Field that I think you said you got to visit today.
I was there today.
I pitched batting practice out there when I was 12 years old. I shagged balls. I did this. My mother went to every Mother's Day, you know, Ladies' Day baseball game at Rickwood. My dad worked, had his own business, but he was through on Sunday. And if the Barons were in town, we went to Rickwood. And if the Barons were out of town, we went downtown after church and went to a picture show.
Did you come from a big family?
Had a brother who was the first person out of our area to ever get a scholarship to a major college. He was a track man. And he got a scholarship to LSU. Frank, my older brother, was a track man, and he got the first scholarship to a major college as anybody that ever came out of our high school. Of course, our high school was 1932, and this was 1936. And he was a good athlete and a good track man, and he wound up with a doctorate in geology. He wound up teaching at Texas Tech. He was very highly acclaimed as a pilot in World War II, flying C-47s or flying supplies and picking up troops and doing this sort of stuff. He got out unscathed. He came out real well. And I may as well go on and tell you this now. I had the scholarship in Mississippi State, and I opted to go in baseball, but I also had the GI Bill of Rights. And I'm from Alabama, and he had been at LSU, and I had not seen my older brother many times since 1936. So I had a choice to go to school wherever I wanted to, and I said, what the hell? I'm going to Baton Rouge and go to LSU. And I went down there, and I got a little static about, you know, you left the scholarship at Mississippi State, and I'd been in baseball for a year and won 21 and lost 9. And Rick, you can imagine I'm Class C, it might have been, but had a pretty good year. And I wanted to go to school down there mostly to be, you know, to see my older brother. He's 8 years older than he was 8 years older than I was. Man, they knew him, and how we went in front of the chancellor and all this sort of stuff. And the chancellor just happened to be a general in the army and this sort of stuff. And he said, "You're from Alabama, and we got too many people in Louisiana." I said, "Hey," and I said, "Hey," because I knew all about those military people from company commanders and battalion commanders and what, but I'd never been in front of a general. And I said, "Hey, I'm honorably discharged veteran from World War II. I want to come to LSU, and the reason I want to come to LSU is to say hello to my brother. I've got the GI Bill of Rights. I'm not going to cost you anything, and if you, I don't want anything from you. I just want to come down here." So they, I don't think my older brother realized. I had a pretty good job in India and Burma during World War II, and then I came out of it fine. Everybody in my platoon, everybody in my company came out of it. I was not an officer. I was a platoon sergeant. And we correspond with those people. But the ones that are of us who are left alive. But I went to LSU, and I had three great half semesters down there, because the guy I knew I was playing baseball, and he said, "Come on." So I did all right. And I got a year and a half of college and got on that 50-pennant winner, and I met my girl that fall of 1949, and Bubba thought he was going to make $3 million. But that's the story of my brother. And my sister is 75. Oh, incidentally, my brother died at 53 with a heart attack. He was had a doctorate in geology, and he was on the staff at Texas Tech, and had been through not only World War II, but had been through the Korean War, retired as a full colonel. And he was at Texas Tech and playing golf and teaching his geology and doing what he had to do, and dropped dead. Now, my daddy died at 47. Now, I'm 71, and I'm looking for wood. But anyway, that's my brother. My sister is 4 years older than I am, and she was the first citizenship girl in the state of Alabama in high school.
Well, what does that mean?
That means, she was a good student. She was a cheerleader. She was a very calm person. And the high school that we all went to put her up for it. And that was the first year, the first citizenship girl in the state of Alabama. That's statewide. She won't even recognize, you know. She's just one of those people. That's just something that comes along in life. She's one of those people, so it expects things in a nice, calm, quiet way. I was different. I used to tell my brother when we were at LSU, I said, "Okay, you ran for a $15 letter. I'm going to throw a baseball." They didn't want me to go to baseball. And I said, "You ran for a $15 sweater. I'm going to throw a baseball for $15,000. That's what my goal was. Of course, he got the doctorate, and he was prepared for life, but God, you know, you never know. I did make my $15,000. I did have an experience that, you know, you just don't have, the relationships, the friends, and it's, you know, it's just, all I can say is, thank you, Jesus. It's been a great life.
What did you said that your dad had his own business. What was it?
My dad had the only fresh seafood market in Birmingham, Alabama. And he got his fish out of Tarpon Springs, Florida. And trucks came. and trucks came. And Saturday night, that was before refrigeration, they used ice. And it was a 6 to 8 job, 6 days a week. Sunday was off. But Rick, I ate more shrimp. I ate more Spanish mackerel. I ate more fish than anybody in the world. And I guess that was great because I love fish to this day. But what he could not sell on Saturday, he gave away, or he traded. So consequently, we had great vegetables, great fish. We were never hungry, and then the Depression comes and all that sort of stuff. He was gone in 1934 before the Depression. He was a sports fan. He had played baseball in his little town, Union City. Back then, if you saw Ken Burns' documentary on baseball and go back to the very beginning where baseball had all the little townships, all the little cities and what have you, I'll show you something in just a second. But all those little towns in Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, they played baseball on Sunday. They played in fields and all this sort of stuff. They didn't have the equipment that we had, but they played baseball. And my dad was a pretty good outfielder. And I'm told that he had a scholarship to Vanderbilt, but he couldn't go because he had to work. But anyway, I had him for the first 10 years of my life. And man, he'd get out there in the middle of the street with us and hit ground balls and hit fly balls. And fortunately, we could all run. My brother could run. I think the most embarrassing moment he ever had in his life is when I outran him from one place to another chasing a squirrel down. And he never beat me again. Turn that thing off just a second. You go from here.
So you became interested in baseball because your dad had played a little bit and then he was out playing with you when you were 10?
No, I hit the ground playing baseball. I hit the ground playing baseball. I could do something with the ball. I could throw a ball. I could, didn't know how to catch it, but I caught it. And I could run. But I loved to play. Just loved the game. We played. We would get up and go play baseball before school started. We would go to school and come out and don't play, but you go do other things. You have things you have to do when you're in grammar school or elementary school. But then it was just baseball, and I knew early on that that's what I wanted to do. I could throw a football. I was slow. Then I haven't learned how to run the last 21 years old, but I sure knew how to run then. But that's all I really wanted in life. And I talked to my fifth grade teacher. My fifth grade teacher is still alive. And we talked. And without those people, Rick, I mean, I had my mother. I had my dad for 10 years. I had an older brother that was a good student. My sister was my sister. Just low-key, just knew where she was going, what she wanted to do, and she did everything she wanted to do. She and her husband were married for 35 years. Peggy and I had nearly 46. But, family, just family. And I mean, this girl you just heard call here, that's family. I never dated this girl in my life, but she's 71 years old too. And we got 4 more people coming to this luncheon tomorrow. So I can't survive without these people. I've never survived this last thing in August without these people and without my people right here. I heard from every one of them. I didn't hear from that. I heard from most of them. And, I I can't begin to tell you. Hope to God nobody ever has to go through it. But we predicated everything in this world on me predeceasing my wife. Didn't happen that way. And I don't want to bring this up. Get back to your baseball.
Okay. Did you play high school or Sandlot or American Legion? Or
I played Gray Y. I played Church League. I played for three teams when I was 12 years old. Then I went into the Gray Y League, which is the youth thing.
Okay.
Then I went to YMCA. And then we have something here in Birmingham, played high school. And we have something in Birmingham that calls the BABF, Birmingham Amateur Baseball Association, Birmingham Federation. And these were people that played with my sister's age group. And got to understand where I came from. I was in grammar school, and the high school coach let me bat boy. The high school coach let me have some hitting practice. He let me get out there and do whatever I thought I could do. But these people were my sister's age, 4 or 5 years older than I was. And then I had the group that was my brother's age, 8 years older than I was. And when I decided I wanted to smell the flowers, and we did things like this, and no matter where I went, there was somebody that would come up. And it'd be somebody that my sister went to school with. My people had no problem, because we're all trying to do the same thing. But my sister's group and my brother's group sort of leveled the boat. I couldn't do anything. If I wanted to do something wrong, I couldn't do it, because somebody was always standing there, and I just could not disappoint anybody in my family, because I was so proud of it. And all I wanted to do was just make my little mark.
What positions did you play when you were growing up?
I pitched. Was too damn slow to do anything else, but I pitched. And I play outfield. I catch the ball, and I could throw the ball. But at that time, I was slow. And then I found out what I wanted to do, and I could go across first base in 3.5 seconds from the right side. I could run, and it just came. You just start doing things. And when I went into Class C out there in Salina, Kansas, I knew what I wanted to do. And I had seen my brother's work ethics. And I had seen football players out there where I went to school, work ethics. And I had seen, let me see if I can put this the right way. I had been exposed to ethnic groups that I had never been exposed to in my life during World War II. I learned about the Polish people. I learned about the Italian people. I learned that we're all just alike. And I had no problem. And I began to see that there's something more than a Caucasian Methodist from Birmingham, Alabama, that there are other places in this world. And I think that sort of opened my eyes. And then I also began to see those people of those ethnic groups that all they wanted to do was go back home. I wanted to go back home. But I also wanted something there was something that I wanted to do. It was not a burning ambition. At that time, I think I never had a doubt in my mind. I told Cindy Wilbert when she came to interview me, I said, I knew that if they gave me that ball, I'd get where I wanted to go. Thank God I had the background, I had the family support, it takes intelligence to play baseball. No dummies really play that game. I mean this. It's gamesmanship. Experiences, it's battles. every hitter is a battle. And you win some battles and you lose some. But anyway, it might have been right for me. It might have been right for me. And then, my God, the people that I played with from Class C to AAA in the majors. What a trip. I wouldn't take, they might make $70 million a year. I'll take what I made and say, thank you, Jesus. We had a great group of people playing baseball with.
What did your family think of you making baseball your career?
My brother didn't like it, and that's when I told him, you know, you ran for your $15 sweater, I'm going to throw a baseball $15,000. My mother was very proud. She didn't understand it. She had seen the Baron play on Ladies' Day at Rickwood, and she knew that I wanted to play baseball. And I had certain things to do around the house, certainly her being a single mother. I mean, my daddy had died, a widow. And we managed very well, but if it was baseball, go. And she used to rub my legs because I'd cramps in my legs and what have you. You know, what the hell, what was your diet? You know, it's not like it is today. But we ate well and we ate good, and I played all the baseball I could play and had so much leadership back at that stage of my life. And then when I got there, my mother came to Philadelphia to the World Series, and she did not go to the game because she just couldn't get in that many people. And
did you have a favorite player or a favorite team when you were growing up?
No. I didn't know anybody's batting average. I'd heard of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig. Those people, of course, the Yankees came through here. Didn't have money enough to go watch the exhibition game because the stands were crowded and all that sort of stuff. And of course, I really did not. I remind myself a lot of Don Madden when somebody asked him, you know, Babe Ruth, he said, I don't know him. I really did not. I knew the local Baron ball players. Yeah, my favorite ball player was a left fielder named Art Luce that played for the Birmingham Barons back in the 30s. And favorite shortstop was a guy named Shine Kataza.
Good name.
Great. And I didn't know anything about pitching or catching or anything. They had a first baseman named Bud Clancy. Just reminded as I grew, you know, got played. Eddie Wakus, our first baseman, reminded me of Bud Clancy, because Bud Clancy was just smooth as so was Wakus. And as I grew older and got into baseball and this sort of stuff, I began to see a parallel. Because it doesn't change. It does, the game is between the lines. It just does not change. You have people that have more grace and what have you. They always talk about DiMaggio being the most graceful center fielder in baseball. I think Duke Snider was the most graceful center fielder that I ever played against. But you take your DiMaggio and you take your Snider and you take your Willie Mays, I'll take that little whitey named Putt-Putt, Richie Ashburn, and guarantee you that he'll catch every mistake that you make. Mm-hmm. He was not the most, but that, these are the people I played with every day. DiMaggio, I only saw during spring training. I only saw in that one World Series, and DiMaggio beat us 2 games, one with his bat. He beat us 3 games, one with his bat and 2 with his glove. Hit home runs off of, against Constantine. They hit a ball off the clock, Shy Park. DiMaggio held a guy to a single. He played it like it's supposed to be played. Then the second game, he hit the home run off of Roberts, hit it on the roof in Shy Park, 2-1. Third game, Hamler hits one to Roos Monument in left center field. DiMaggio goes over and picks it up on the hop and holds Hamler to a double. So that's baseball. But then you think about the things that little Richie Ashburn did. You know, God knows, I've thrown him, and he'd run for miles and come up. Last time I saw him, he said, you know, you put me in the Hall of Fame. I said, yeah, I know the play you're talking about. So this is the fun that you have in this stuff now. Now, the greatest ball player I ever saw in my life or played against was Stan Musial. Day to day. Never saw him make a bad throw. He could play first base. He could play the outfield. Never saw him make a bad throw anywhere. And he was an inspiration because we would go into St. Louis on a road trip. Stan Musial and Red Chandies would be out there at 4:30 in the afternoon playing catch, playing their little game. And when he got in that batter's box, it was work. You win some, you lose some. Chandies was great. But the people I played against, Stan, I think, of course, you got to bear in mind that I love my Phillies, and I will not, I have nothing in the world. Stan, like you talked about Stan LaPata, you met him out there. Stan LaPata could take a change up and hit it to right center field, and I mean drive it. He had patience. Big, strong. He's the guy that stepped up in front of home plate and put Cal Abrams out 10 feet in front of home plate. But these things, you know, Stan was a hard-working guy. We had Semenik, the Mad Russian. Jimmy Bloodworth used to call him, Bloodworth used to call Andy the Mad Russian. And I've seen him catch a ball game with a separated bone in his ankle, just get it shot. I saw him get hit. And it'd be blue and all this sort of stuff, and you think he would give no way. But he'd always come out of there. Hey. But the catcher that I thought I would always like to be, Andy Semenik knew me. He knew, he's born September the 12th just like I am. He's a Virgo just like I am, and he knew me. But the catcher that I think I would have liked to pitch to was Roy Campanella. And there was another one named Del Rice. And there was another one named Joe Garagiola. And don't you ever underrate Joe Garagiola. He was a good receiver. Joe was. And, you just sit here and start asking these questions, start going over these things. Yeah. This, I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people. I didn't know until 30 years later what it really meant to be in that era, to be with those people. We competed. We wanted to win. But we respected each other. We respected each other. And I think we knew, we took more time trying to figure out how you gonna get this guy out, how you gonna get that guy out. Nothing stereotyped. And the only problem I have with baseball today is they got these guys that walk out there and throw 100-mile-an-hour fastball before innings, and they come to bring somebody in that throws 185 miles an hour for two innings, and they bring somebody else and do this. So they use three or four pitchers a game. The pride and was pitch nine innings, pitch that 27th out. Pitch the 27th out. And I can think of so many pitchers. I think of Harry Bukin, Alf Brazel with St. Louis. Max Lanier. I would rather have seen Larry Jansen, a right-handed pitcher with the Giants, pitch a ball game than any right-hander I knew. I can go back right now, and I won't bore you, and I won't take the time to do it, but Jim Hearn was a very deliberate pitcher with the Giants. His ball game lasted 3 hours. But we always said that's because Jim liked to sell more popcorn and peanuts than anybody else. But he was deliberate. It, you know, that was just his style. But everybody had their own style. And then I'll take Kurt Simmons for the left-hander. My God, what a talent that guy is. And I'll take Robbie for my right-hander. Of course, I played with him. I saw them. And we had a guy named Bob Miller that could throw his little old slop damn curveball. He could throw it in a thimble. We had a gray fox named Kenny Heinzman. I mean, these people I played with, and we studied each other, and we didn't tell each other what to do. We didn't do this. We didn't say, hey, do it this way. Go get them, babe. That's what really what it was all about. Because, you know, there's only... I will share this with you. We learned to pitch the Connie Mack theory of pitching, which is up and down, in and out. Two out of the first three strikes for pitches, the decision on the 2-2 pitch. That may you got a snappy, you know, everybody's up. I had a guy I coached for Miami, Bob Carpenter, gave me a job down there, and I went back to try to pitch, and I wanted to pitch, but I was not going back to Philadelphia to mop up. I was not going back to do anything. If I couldn't go up there and start, I didn't want to go, which I didn't do, but anyway, I stayed down there and coached. And I had a pitcher named Satchel Paige down there. And Satch must have been 50, 52, 53 years old, something like that. And the first time I ever saw him pitch, I went to his locker after the ball game, and I said, Satch, I saw you start on this end of the rubber, come to the middle, come over here, get back on top of the rubber, go up in front of the rubber, do this and do that. I said, what were you doing? And he said, that's the way I get my trying, okay? And I said, the triangle. So I told him, I said, we learn up and down, in and out, and all this sort of stuff. And I said, are you telling me that you got a triangle up, which is the top of the triangle, and it's right on the corner, and you got the other corner goes out this way. I don't know the mathematical term for it, but what I'm saying is, here's a here represents home plate, okay? We learn up and up, down, in and out. Satch was so fine that he had a triangle. That was his triangle. And when he told me that's where I get my triangle, I said, Satch, of course I read about him. I said, you got a pitch here, you got a pitch here, you got a pitch here. He said, yeah. He said, hometown said, you're the only one that's ever caught that thing in your life, in my life. And I thought about that, and I thought about it, and he could not throw a chain, he couldn't throw a change up, he couldn't throw a slider, he couldn't throw a curveball. All he could do was take a fastball, but he could hit a thimble. The most amazing man, pitching-wise, most patience I ever saw in a pitcher in my life. And everything the guy that I asked him, he answered every question I had asked him. And I used to enjoy taking, I was his pitching coach, and I used to go out there and he put on a show. He was a showman. And I didn't know this until, I didn't know baseball was show business. Until Robbie said it a few years ago, that it's not baseball anymore, it's show business. Well, I liked it when it was baseball. But I had to put on a show, and you always had people to put on a show. But I put a towel on home plate and start him off, and then I told the plate up and he'd do what he's going to do, and I told the glove up. he'd hit the glove. Most uncanny pitcher, knowledgeable, most patience I've ever seen in a pitcher in my life. He was in my lifetime. If that man had been able to pitch when he was a young man, God knows where he would have gone. God knows what he could have accomplished. But believe Ken Burns' documentary. I'm serious. Give me some more questions. I'm running out of steam.
Well, real quick, tell me about the time you spent in war. Where were you in? Were you with any other ball players? Or?
No. I was in World War II. I was in India and Burma. And I had had ROTC when I was in high school. And I was in the Army 31 days, and I was made a corporal. I was in there another 31 days, and I was a sergeant. And by then, we were on a train going to the West Coast to get on a troop ship to go to India, and I was made a platoon sergeant. And I was 18 years old, and only because I had been had ROTC. We were in a quartermaster group, and we were in India and Burma and this sort of stuff, and I wound up with 120 people, and then my company commander, who is now dead, said, the only thing I want you to do is make sure they got clean socks on. You take care of them. So the first air raid I ever went through, I got my people in the damn slit trenches. And I was in the slit trenches, and here comes this old goat, and that's what we used to call him. His name was Billingmeyer, and he had been in the service all of his life. And he said, where is Sergeant Church? And I said, I'm right here. He said, get out of that damn slit trench and get up here and tell these people what to do. I said, you're up there. You tell them what to do. I'm down here. So we laughed about that. Turn that thing off. I'm ready.
All right, Bubba, tell me about going to see Ben Chapman in his bowling alley when you got out of service.
Okay, the summer of 1946, I had played in the BABF, which I had mentioned earlier. And people from the Tigers and people from the Cardinals, the Tigers and the Cardinals were very big in this area. And I had played for Stockholm Pipe and Valve. I really started playing with a guy, an electrician, who was a guy who had an electric business, and he paid us $35 a game, and I played for him until he went broke. Then I went to McCord Lumber Company, who wasn't worried about going broke, and $35 a game, you know, not too bad. And, you know, for a guy right out of the Army making $116 a month, making $70 a week, wasn't too bad. And anyway, we played, and then here comes the Mississippi States offer, and I go down there from September until late November, and I decided, hey boy, you've been in India and Burma for 2.5 years. There's no traffic lights over there, and there's no electric lights over there, and everything is by lamp and candle, and here you are in Starkville, Mississippi, and they had one traffic light. I said, you're 22 years old, you're going in baseball, you better go. So I went straight to Duty Noble, who was a baseball coach down there, and I said, hey, coach, I want to go in baseball. He said, you go. He said, the first person you talk to is Ben Chapman when you get home. To go on down there and talk to him, and if you don't, you know, go talk to him, make up your mind what you know, you got your scholarship. Come on back. I said, just go on down there. And then I talked to a couple of guys that had managed here, and one of them was a fellow named Charlie Chappell, who had managed the Stockholm Pipe and Valve in the BABF. It was Industrial League, is what it was. And the people that we played against were people that had jobs like the Stockholm Pipe and Valve, and I was invited over there, and I watched those baseball players sitting up there working that line. I went to SIPCO and saw a little baseball player doing that stuff with that steel, and I said, that's not for me. And that's just not for me. So anyway, three people said, Coach Duty Noble down in Mississippi State said, go talk to Ben before you go. And Charlie Chapel said, go talk to Ben. There's a guy named Berto Vines who had coached the SIPCO pipe company for years. Talk to Ben before you do anything. So I went into Chapman's Bowling Alley when I got home. And he said, well, I heard about you. And he said, what do you want to do? He said, what do you play? I said, hell, I can play the outfield. I can play, I can pitch. I can do anything. I'm going to play baseball. He said, well, I've heard some good things about you. And he said, what do you think you're worth? Now, first he asked me, he said, how long do you think it'll take you to get there? I said, well, I've got the GI Bill of Rights, and I'm thinking about leaving the scholarship. And I'll give myself 3 years to get there. He said, hell, if you're not there in 3 years with what we've got up there right now, I said, you need to go back to school or go to work. Well, then the next question he asked me, he said, what do you think you're worth? I said, $1 million. He said, you won't get that from me. He said, I'll give you $1,500 to sign, and I'll give you $500 with the ball club you go with on June the 1st. I said, okay, I want to play baseball. He called Herb Pennant. He said, I don't know whether he's a pitcher or catcher. Chapman wanted me to play the outfield. Pennant, when I got spring training, Pennant wanted me to be a pitcher. So, guy in Class B, they had all classifications in. A guy in Class B in Terre Haute, Indiana, wanted me to go with him, and Chapman said, uh-uh, he's going to Salina where he can play the outfield and pitch too, so I did, and the rest is just it.
Did you drive with Ben Chapman down to spring training that first year?
First year. He said, I'm going to take you spring training with you. So we rode, and we talked, and Ben was a great friend of mine. A lot of people didn't like Ben. I'm no judge. All I know is a sports writer named the sports writers in New York, one with AP, one with UP, loved Ben Chapman. And I'll think of the names in a minute. But I mean, they were champions of Ben Chapman. And they, you know, Ben was a no-no by the time I got there. Because of the Robinson controversial thing and a couple of other controversial things and what have you. I never, ever in my life would say anything other than Ben Chapman was my friend and is my friend and will be my friend as long as I hope I live and he lives, and it's the way it has been. Ola, Ben's wife, was at my wife's funeral. Ola and I have talked a half a dozen times, and Ben was Ben, and take him like he is. He was a good baseball man, and I don't know. But I'm so close to these names. But Joe Reichler was a champion of men, and always was. And then, you know, it must have been a fraternity. It must have been something that was just, you live, you experience, and what have you. And as I said, I didn't really appreciate it until, let's say, the last 10, 15 years. And these cards keep coming in, and these letters keep coming in, and people keep talking about our era and our era. And I'm just grateful to God that I had the ability and had the desire and was fortunate enough to play with these people and play against these people. I think Jackie Robinson was one of the greatest competitors I ever saw in my life. But then I look at Sam Jethro. He was a great competitor. And everybody's got a weakness. Sam Jethro didn't like to slide. Jackie would do anything in the world to beat you. And then you go back to the umpire, like Jocko Kahn. These are people, Dusty, Bogus. They were part of the game. My God, they used to come out to the ballpark early. We'd go out to the ballpark, and we could work out and do everything else. And we could go behind the batting cage and watch the other people hit and talk to the umpires. And you know, and God knows, the first time I ever pitched, God, was it? I've got blanks. Blanks are coming at me right now. You could go to the umpire and say, you know, what did you see? And he would tell you. They didn't give you anything. They knew you, and they knew what you would do. My God, I had Frank Descoli internationally. Frank Descoli knew me. He knew what I was thinking, what I was going to do. And I always told him, Frank, you're so damn long-legged, get down and give me the low pitch. You can't see it. You're looking on top of it. And we both hit the National League same time. And like I say, there are a couple of them up there that knew me. They knew what I was going to do. And okay, maybe you got an edge. Because they knew what I was thinking. And then here I had good catchers. I had Hal Wagner in Toronto. And Hal Wagner could lead me like lead a sheep to slaughter. He just follow his glove. Just follow his glove. And really and truly, Hal Wagner taught me more about following the glove. You know, it's just baseball. pitching is nothing in the world but control. And that was Connie Mack's theory. Two out of the first three pitches were strikes. Decision on 2-2 pitch. Control. Del Wilbur, Cindy Wilbur's daddy, came to us from the Cardinals. And he didn't mind getting down there and warming you up or working with you. We would pitch batting practice for 15, 20 minutes, something like that, and then go off. We were routine. Go off on the side and really get our work. And Dell shook me one day. He took home plate and he covered half of it up with gravel. You know, just break it over. I said, what are you doing? He said, I want you to hit this part of the plate. New game. It's all games. New game. It's a challenge. He gave me a challenge. And boy, when we get out here 2-1, 3-2, something like that, you go back to the gravel and take the shot. You know, you do or you don't. But it's pitching, all pitching is changing speeds. Freedom Maddox is such a great pitcher. I'm telling you, he could win in any era. I don't know how many, again, as far as I can figure, he's got about five pitches and he can throw strikes with every one of them. Rick, I had a great career, short as it was. And, I enjoyed it, and I enjoy it now. probably more so than I did when you're sitting out there very young and thinking, you know, you're just going to win every one of them, but you never quite learn how to lose. You know how to win. And I honestly believe that I played during the great era where there were 400 people out there that loved the game and respected each other and played. The money wasn't there, but that was baseball then. And I think it's a tragedy. I will say this, I'm not very opinionated, but I think when they broke the reserve clause, I don't think baseball was ever slavery as they portray it as it was. I think there was loyalty back then. There's no loyalty now. I think when they started guaranteeing contracts for 3 or 4 years and stuff like that, I think that was... And then the real baseball people, of course, I only knew the Carpenters. Crosby was in Cincinnati. He was one of those absentee owners. So was Mr. Wrigley. He was more interested in Los Angeles or his L.A. Angels than he was in the Cubs, because he's going to draw a million and a half every year before Milwaukee got there. But that comes later. Chicago was a great place to play baseball because you played in the daytime. Cincinnati was hot. But was hot. But for baseball, for me, Shy Park. Oh, Lord, I'd take Shy Park. Field was symmetrical. You got 415-foot center field, and don't think for 1 minute I hadn't thrown one to the base of that 415-foot, and Richie went back and caught it. And I've thrown them as far as anybody has ever thrown them in this world, but I've also gotten a few of them out. But it was a great life. It, to me, it was the only life, and we all get older and we all lose it. And I have no regrets. I had 3 children, and I had no problems. I just got a wife that I love very dearly, and 3 children that I've. One, my oldest daughter, had been in 17 schools by the time she was 12 years old, so I didn't like that. And too many people in baseball said it's not going to hurt them. It probably would not have, but I had my roots here. And I always came back to Alabama. And thank God I did.
Well, go back to Ben Chapman and that drive down to spring training. I don't think it's any secret that he was probably Jackie Robinson's biggest, I don't know exactly what word to use, but he certainly wasn't his biggest fan. And it was also, I don't think, any secret when you folks were driving down to spring training in 47 what Ricky had in mind with Robinson to bring him up. I was just curious if Ken talked about him at all.
Never said a word. No. The race issue never came up. All we talked about was getting the lead off of first base. He talked baseball, and I understood what he was talking about, and he fussed at me because I kicked off my shoes and was sitting on the passenger side with nothing but a sock feet on, and he said, "Put your shoes on." I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" I said, "You got the heater on? My feet are hot. Maybe my shoes, you put your shoes on. You'll catch a cold." I said, "I ain't going to catch a cold. I've been barefooted all my life. I hope to make enough money with your baseball team to buy some shoes that fit me." But then, that was Ben. Of course, understand, I had been through a war. And Ben was like 15 years older than I was. But I'd been around a lot of people that 15 years older than I was. And like I say, I had been through a war. And I came out of that thing with no problems whatsoever. I had an ambition, and I didn't, you know, I All I knew is I wanted to play baseball, but here's a guy that had a good sense of humor. He was a good family man. And he was one hell of a baseball player. He was opinionated. He was not Jackie Robinson's biggest enemy. Back then, if you go back to it and you talk to enough people, you'll find out that that was baseball. I mean, pre-war, pre-World War II, baseball players jumped on anybody. They did it. You can even see it in the Burns documentary, how they got on each other. And I remember 1947, Joe Garagiola is catching for the Cardinals, and I'm watching the exhibition game, and you know what the Phillies did? You remember the clog that you used to use? The wooden, you don't know what a clog is.
No, I'm not.
Things that you slip your feet in, it's got a thing over it, and it's wooden to go to the shower, so okay. You don't get athlete's foot. Right. About six of them came out there, Garagiola's talking, and Joe's the sweetest guy God ever put on this earth. You know what they did? They brought those things out there and said, "Hey, Joe, motor mouth," you know. But Joe had a great sense of humor, and he just gave it right. But anyway, they did that to people then. That was baseball. That was part of it. It never hurt Robinson. It never hurt him. But Ben had the reputation, I've talked to him about it. I mean, after we were both out of baseball and what have you, and he said, "Hell yes, he was great. He was the greatest competitor. He was a good competitor." And I won't tell you the rest of it.
Okay. In the 47 spring training, you also got to meet Babe Ruth?
48. I went back to spring training with him in 48. And then I went that. Now, of course, I had 121, lost 9 in Class C, and we go to spring training. Ben said, "You're going back down there with me." So we go, and he let the Yankees come to town, and he let me pitch against the Yankees. And I'm sitting there, and I'm watching Charlie Keller, and I'm watching DiMaggio, and I'm watching Phil Rizzuto, which is another sweet guy. I'm watching Barra. I had played against Joe Collins, who played first base, and hell, I can't remember the rest of them. Bobby Brown was on third base, and I'm watching them take infield practice and all that sort of stuff. And in Clearwater, Florida, they might seat 1,800, 2,000 people, and the fans were buzzing as they usually do. The stands were buzzing, and all of a sudden, you couldn't hear that. And there he is. And I'm saying, "There, who is, pointing to?" I looked down the third baseline, and then the dressing room for our clubhouse was down here, and there was a gate, and come down and get out of it, and here he comes down the third baseline, Mr. Ruth, and Red Patterson was with him. And the man was as brown as that cabinet over there, and he had in his brown, light tan coat and cap and all that sort of stuff. And Rick, he walked about 10 steps, and all he did was just took that left hand and put up and did that. And if there were 1,000 people or 2,000 people, it just went bonkers. I had cold chills run up and down my spine. I realized who it was. So he came on over and came to our bench first. And I'm sitting there next to Ben, and he said, "Hello, Chappie, how are you?" And he said, "Okay." And he sat down. And Ben said, "I want you to meet my starting pitcher." And so he told him what my name was. And he said, "Oh, good luck, kid." That sort of stuff. Cold chills ran down my back again. And I didn't even shake hands with him. I just said, "Thank you." And, because that might have been me, I don't know. But I met the man, and I think one of the greatest thrills I ever had in baseball in my life is to see, realize who the guy was coming down the third baseline and see him do that. Because that was it. And then, again, I refer to Ken Burns' documentary. That was his salute.
And then tell me about going to see the Babe Ruth story with Will Bendix.
Lord knows, of course, when it came out and all that sort of stuff, went to see it, and I sat there and cried like a baby. You always do. I do this all the time. You know. But it was just great. Just great. It's been a great life. It's a great game.
The 3 years, and real quick, it started off in Salina.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Class C.
Class C.
In the Western Association. And who was the manager out there?
Eddie Walls.
Eddie Walls. How did the, how did Salina do that year?
We won the pennant.
Oh.
I won 21 and lost 9. A guy named Hartley won 22 and lost 5.
He won the championship of the league?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's good. And then you went up to Toronto?
We got a $22 groin watch.
That was your gift?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the 2 years in Toronto.
Went to Toronto, won 4 out of 5 ball games early on, and then they caught up with me real quick, and I ran my ass off, and I worked harder and harder, but it just was not to be. And I was ready, and I went back to LSU, and I was ready to say, this game's too big for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, but my base on ball strikeout ratio in Salina was 4-1, and God only, I don't know, but anyway, I won 5 and lost 9. And I went back to LSU and got back into my routine, and I said, no way, baby. And I went back to Toronto and led the league in earned run averages, won 15 and lost 9.
Was Eddie Sawyer the manager out there at the time?
He was there in 48. Chapman got fired in June of 48. Sawyer went up there, and we got a guy named Del Bisonette. And Del Bisonette told me late in the year, now we got a guy named Dick Carter that took over from Eddie Sawyer in 48, which was everybody loves him and all that sort of stuff, but he was toward the end of the line, and he just a fill-in job, and he knew it and what have you. And he's a nice guy, but I didn't get anything out of him, and I was finished for the year anyway. But anyway, I went back and rededicated myself and found out where I was. And then we had a guy named Del Bisonette that managed Toronto in 1949. Del Bisonette took me early on, and he said, how many pitches you got, Bubba? I said, I got 4 or 5. He said, I want you to junk all of them but the fastball and curveball. I want you to throw a fastball, it'll take something off of it. Throw a curveball, it'll take something off of it. That means you got 4 pitches. I did it. I won 15, lost 9, led the league in earned run averages, and I knew I was going to pitch in Philadelphia in 1950.
I need to backtrack for just a second. I skipped over a question that I do need to ask. Tell me the circumstances around you being signed to your first contract. Who was it? Chapman that signed
you? Yeah, it was Chapman, yeah. He called Herb Pennant from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And I liked Ben going on, and I liked him being positive and all that. And the promises of riding to spring training with him never entered my mind. The promises of money never entered my mind. But he said one thing that made sense to me. And you got to realize that I might not be a 5'8 Kappa, but I ain't no dummy. I know people, and I knew people. And when he said, if you're not there in 3 years, you better go back to school. You better turn that off, because I got to go back. You're going to have to edit it, and you're going to do with it what you want to do with it. But I went spring training, and there were people that had played Major League Baseball. Scooie Rowe was there, and there were others there, and I'm watching these people pitching in the bullpen, warming up and doing what you do in spring training and stuff like that. And we had a little guy named Blix Donnelly that came from the Cardinals, from Olivia, Minnesota. And Blix was a little guy, and he had played on the Cardinals in the 42 World Series and knew how to pitch and knew what he, and this sort of stuff, but he was there. He was there in 48, and I had had the good year and all this sort of stuff, but anyway, 47. I'm standing in the line, and we had a catcher. We had a coach named Benny Mingau who had been with the Yankees, and Benny had a mitt as big as you are. And one of those old-timey mitts. And you get back in there and you start warming up, and Benny can make your fastball pop. I mean, it's like a shotgun going off. And he was one of these little motivating guys, and this good and that's good, and come on, come on, come on. So I watched Robbie pitch. He was in line, Robbie, and then Kirk, and then I was in line. And Blix was after me. And I'm watching Robbie pop the ball and throw the ball, and I'm watching Kirk throw the ball. And as you know, Kirk had one of them wild damn deliveries, if you ever seen pictures of him pitch. His right leg would go back around the third base, but anyway. He had snap. Robbie had snap. And I'm standing there looking at that, and I said it. And I guess I must have been a sort of a brash. I don't know what I wasn't. But anyway, I'm thinking to myself, I got $1,500. This guy gets $25,000, and this left-hander gets $65,000. And Blix heard me. I said, my God, I got a better curveball than either one of them got. And Blix heard me, but he didn't say anything. And then I go have the good year and come back in 48. And I have a lousy year in 48, and Blix is still with us. I may be wrong on my year, but anyway, I get to the point where the sports writers are interviewing me. And I'm giving credit to Ben, I'm giving credit to Bert O'Vine from Pacifico, from Charlie Chapel, and credits all the way along the line, and which I told the truth. I didn't do it all by myself. Mm-hmm. I had motivation, I had something to work for, something I wanted to do. And Blix said, but you did the work. And I've never forgotten it as long as I live. You did, damn right I did the work. I had the motivation and what have you. But I thought to myself, and of course they've proven right. I got $1,500, Robbie got $25, and what the hell, you know, he had longevity. He was there. Kirk got his money, and Robbie said Kirk was more promoted than he was, and of course nobody knew anything about baseball, but Kurt was great. They're both great, and they're both still alive and doing well, and they're both with the same wives and all this sort of mm-hmm. stuff, and good family men, and every degree of success they've got, they played a great part in my life. But I never will forget saying, if those people are worth that kind of money, I'm worth the same kind of money. But I had a hell of a lot more to prove.
What do you remember about your first day in the big leagues?
I never felt so excited in all my life. Robbie won, beat Brooklyn 2-1 or 3-2, something like that, in Philadelphia. And I'm the best cheerleader on that damn baseball team. Mm-hmm. I never will forget going to that locker and having that uniform with my number on it in church. I still got it. It's hanging. I still got it.
So what number did you wear?
23. 23,
okay.
Bobby Thompson used to come by me and say, hey, number 23, I hope we have a good year. Because he wore 23, too.
That was just the number they gave you? No specific, yeah.
No reason. Okay. But my name was in the uniform. And I had that favorite cap.
How How did, would you, when you were a rookie and you first come up in 1950, how were you treated by the other guys on the team? Were you they happy to see you, or were you a guy that was taking the job of one of their old-time buddies? And
I think Sawyer answered that question better than anybody's ever answered it. I didn't get to pitch. I was the rookie, and Bob Miller was off, and he won 8 and lost 9. And Robbie's doing his good job, and Kurt's doing his good job, and Kenny's doing his job, and I didn't get to pitch. And I had been used to pitching 230, 240 innings a year. And here I'm sitting down in the bullpen, and I'm working every day. Kenny Silvestri, one of the bullpen catchers, is working me every day, and I'm doing everything, but I'm not getting to pitch. And I was at the point, in fact, I went to Eddie and said, "Hey, Skip, I can't pitch here. Get me somewhere where I can pitch." And he said, "No." He said, "If I didn't think you could help this ball club, you wouldn't be here." And he answered it better than anybody else. And I finally got to pitch in July. It was great until I got missed with a fastball on Krasuski.
Well, we're going to talk about that. In August, the Phillies were playing the Giants, and Andy Semenek, I guess, was at the plate, and Eddie Stanky was out, wherever he was playing that day, waving his arms. Right. Something was going on, and then Semenek ran into, he knocked Hank Thompson out of third, and then he barrel rolled into Bill Rigney, and it was a big fight.
And Rigney weighed about 165 pounds, and jumped right in Andy's face, right in his middle, and Andy just sat there, and I could look like he just took a deep breath, and pow, pow, Rigney, go up, up, up. Everybody came on the field. And I probably queried any chances I ever had of going to the Giants or being traded to the Giants ever, because I caught DeRosa, and I threw his ass from about shortstop halfway to left field. And he never forgot it. I don't think he did.
Was that the best fight you were ever involved in? Or?
There was no fight. There was no fight. A lot of milling around, all that sort of stuff. But it sort of course, Willie Jones would start a fight. Hamler would start a fight. Willie would just, you know, he just, it was part of the pattern, but that was the biggest melee that I've ever been in my life or saw. But hell, everybody came and everybody charged out there and all that sort of stuff. And like all baseball fights,
a lot of dancing.
A lot of dancing, a lot of this and a lot of that. And I never will get Monty Irwin. I think he's from Mobile, Alabama, and he was a big part of the Giant Ball Club. And I looked up, and Monty's got a bat in his hand. And he's got it, and he's going to protect himself and what have you. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And I said, "Money, don't. Just put it down." And this guy's gone on to be, you know. But he just looked at me. I looked at him, and I'm watching that bat.
I don't blame you. Tell me about getting hit by Krasuski.
Well, Ted, if you know anything about Ted, Ted's a big, strong guy. And Ted would always take a strike. And the way I pitched Ted was I knew I was going to get the strike, so just do what Connie Mack said. 2 out of the first 3 pitches for strikes, and then go from there. And I got my strike. And then Ted, I've seen Ted hit pitches up here. I've seen Ted hit pitches down there. But the way I pitched it was to go in on his hands so he couldn't get, you know, the big swing and the big part of the bat on the bat and try to pitch to his hands and then just start, let's say, down around his waist and then just keep walking. So I got 2 strikes on him and some, you know, you throw different speed pitches and what have you. And I wanted my damn out pitch, and I missed with it just about 4 inches. 4 inches I missed. I got too much of the inside part of the plate. And he got every stitch on it, and I saw the ball off his bat. got my glove up here, but ball took my glove, and all I know is I saw the ball took my glove, I hit my glove, and I didn't get it clean, because it comes back a little quicker.
Yeah.
But then pow, and I'm following the ball, and I saw I was moving and following the ball, and my but I didn't know what had happened, but I saw Dale Ennis field the ball on one hop in right field, but I couldn't stop. It just kept going. I went about a 360 degree, and next thing I know, I'm down there on my knees, and I've got my hands over my head.
Yeah, I've seen that picture.
And blood was running, and all I could think of was I'd heard about some guy in the stands getting the line drive here, you know, and the ball hit him in his eye. Ball just ran out, and that's all, like, my damn eyeball was running out, and I didn't know what to do. But I was down, and I got up before they got there. Got up on my knees anyway, and by that time everybody's out there and all that kind of stuff. And I'm out of the ball game, and I've seen the pictures too. The damn glove was halfway to second base, and my cap was off my head, and it just took this eyelid and stuck it up here and cut me across to here. And get in there, and I'm on the damn table, and I don't know what's wrong. And my wife is pregnant with our first baby, and all this big ball game. And somebody came in and said, "Hell, they looked," and they said, "Well, he ain't hurt. He just got hit in the head. If it hit him in the foot, it killed him," or something like that. But next thing I know, I'm on the way to the hospital, and Babe Alexander, our promotions man, is riding with me, and I said, "Babe, I don't know how bad it is, don't know anything about it, but do me a favor. Call my wife and call my mother." And they did. And get to the hospital, in the Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia. Get off the elevator, and there's old Big Nick, Bill Nicholson, saying he had been in the hospital for a few days with diabetics. And he said, "Well, I heard you coming." You know, he's from Chestertown, Maryland. He said, "Well, I heard you coming, Babe." He said, "Come on up here. We'll listen to the rest of the ball game." I said, "Fuck the ball game. I got the worst headache I've ever had in my life." But we sat there and listened to the damn ball game, and Kenny Heinzman came in, it was an extra inning ball game. We won it 2-1. But I'm out of there in 8 days.
They did
plastic surgery, and that, you know. But I missed with a fastball about 4 inches, and he got it, and I could have killed him. Because I was moving pretty good about that. I'm talking about winning, pitching good, and all this sort of stuff. And Ted never called.
Really?
And I was a little bit upset with him about that and all that sort of stuff. And I played with Ted in Cincinnati later.
Right.
And God has never put a more even-minded, one-way person in this world